This is Alfred Beauvais, Editor-in-Chief of AXL. AXL is the American College of Cardiology Extended Learning Series, featuring conversations in cardiology with the scientists who conduct research in our field and the clinicians who are translating that research into clinical practice. You are about to hear an interview from our latest issue. As an AXL subscriber, you will receive 24 new interviews each month. Plus, depending on your subscription level, we'll have access to hundreds of interviews in our digital library. With AXL, you can stream or download your content for convenient offline access on your mobile device, and each interview qualifies for CME credit and MOC self-assessment points. For more information, visit acc.org/ACCEL.
Listen now to a talk Michael Huesketch had with Dr. Sanjay Kaul, cardiologist at the Cedars-Sinai Medical Center in Los Angeles, California. They cover PFO closure, state of the data.
Dr. Kaul, welcome to AXL.
Thank you for inviting me.
Maybe as a way of introducing the topic, if you could tell us what's the incidence of PFOs and how are they related to cryptogenic stroke?
In the younger population, the prevalence of PFO is as high as 25%. And obviously, this is age-dependent, and it's quite common.
And how, then, is the relationship with cryptogenic stroke?
Yes, PFO, especially if it's a large shunt PFO, is a predictor of increased stroke incidence.
Now, when we talk about PFO closure, my understanding has been that the initial three randomized trials did not show any benefit to PFO closure over medical therapy. Could you summarize those three trials for us?
Yeah, the three trials were the Closure 1, which was the first trial that was reported, and then there was the RESPECT trial and the PC trials that used the St. Jude's, the Amplatzer occluder device. And there are many reasons why the trials were inconclusive. They were powered to detect an implausibly large difference in event rate. Two of the trials were powered to detect a 67% relative risk reduction in recurrent strokes. They were actually misled by the observational studies that showed a nearly 80% risk reduction in stroke recurrence. These observational studies were confounded, and so they overestimated the treatment benefit. As a result, even though these trials showed a treatment difference in favor of the device closure, they were inconclusive because they were not sufficiently powered to detect a smaller difference. So that was one of the principal reasons why these trials failed to win on their primary endpoint. The good news was that at least in two trials, PC and RESPECT, there were no increased risk of procedural complications other than atrial fibrillation incidents.
So what was it in these three trials that led the FDA back in October of 2016 to approve a PFO closure device?
Right. The FDA's criteria for approving devices is quite different than what they use for approving drugs or biologics. Over the last half a dozen years, there's been an emphasis on a life cycle approach where the regulatory burden of proof has shifted from a pre-approval phase to a pre-approval as well as post-approval phase. And in the pre-approval phase, the FDA wants to ensure that the devices are safe. And then the sponsors have to conduct a post-approval study to demonstrate that there is reasonable assurance of efficacy and safety in the real-world scenario. So clearly, the efficacy endpoint was not met in these trials, especially the RESPECT trial, which was the pivotal trial for the Amplatzer occluder device. But it was safe. And on the basis of reasonable assurance of safety, the FDA, even with some degree of uncertainty in the efficacy data, approved the device.
So is there now more data out there to either support the use of these devices or not support them?
Yes, last year there were two new trials that reported the results. One was the REDUCE trial, and the other one was the CLOSE trial. And both of them reported positive results with device closure. And one of the reasons why I think the results were positive was because there was careful patient selection. In both these trials, a significant number of patients were enrolled on the basis of large shunt. 80 to 100% of patients had evidence of moderate to large shunt, as defined by the number of bubbles that cross within the first three cardiac cycles. Number one. Number two, the medical therapy was mandated by the protocol, either as antiplatelet or as antiplatelet and anticoagulant therapy. In the previous three trials, the medical therapy was left to the discretion of the investigators, and that sort of introduced some noise added to the uncertainty in the treatment effects. So I think the careful selection of patients, especially patients with a large shunt or mobile atrial septum, what we call atrial septal aneurysm, led to an effective closure of the device, and therefore the treatment effects were quite impressive. In the CLOSE trial, there were zero recurrent stroke events in the device arm compared to, I think, 12 or 16 in the medical therapy arm. And there are newer trials that have sort of learned from the experience of these two positive trials and are now enrolling patients with high-risk PFO characteristics based purely on the anatomy of the PFO rather than by excluding patients that have conventional risk factors for stroke.
You had mentioned earlier about one of the potential complications is atrial fibrillation.
Right.
And I think that as interventionalists, we always wonder too about long-term device status, device erosion. These two trials now that have been published, did they highlight anything about atrial fibrillation or device erosion?
Yes. Device erosion is, the concern about that has been allayed. This is not a big issue at all. I think one or two cases in these trials. But atrial fibrillation continues to be an increased risk with the device closure. But luckily, most of these events cluster within the first 30 to 45 days. And despite the increased risk of atrial fibrillation, the stroke event rate is very low, which basically indicates that atrial fibrillation is not clinically important. It does not have a downstream adverse clinical outcome related to it. Some have argued that perhaps we should monitor these patients for probably 14 days or about a month using these Zio patch monitors to see whether these are transient or whether they are permanent atrial fibrillation, because then that would change the medical therapy. These patients would be candidates for anticoagulant therapy rather than antiplatelet therapy.
So having said that, what's your current strategy once one of these devices has been put in regards to antiplatelet versus anticoagulation or both?
Right now, the guideline recommendations are antiplatelet, but there is a lot of uncertainty. It's not been resolved. There are some studies, but the results are inconclusive simply because the studies were not adequately powered to resolve this choice of antithrombotic therapy. Currently, the guideline recommendations emphasize antiplatelet therapy, but if you have somebody who has history of DVTs or has thrombophilia or has sustained atrial fibrillation, then that's the patient where I would add anticoagulant therapy. That's why it's very important to do in your workup. You have to make sure that the patient does not have a permanent indication for anticoagulant therapy.
So you'd mentioned the guidelines, and given these recent two trials that have showed efficacy as far as reduction of recurrent stroke, what is the status of our guidelines right now?
The American Heart and the American Stroke Association came up with the latest guidelines in 2014. And based on those three null trials, they basically did not endorse routine use of the PFO closure. Only if you had a PFO and you had evidence of DVT, then the recommendation was class 2B, level B recommendation, not a very strong recommendation for that. The American Academy of Neurology came up with their practice advisory in 2016, and they had access to all these three trial data, and they also did not endorse because the results were not favorable. Following the results of these two trials that I talked about, the reduce and the close trial, the Canadian best practice recommendations were updated in November of 2017. And this is the first guideline that formally endorses the use of PFO closure. But the selection criteria is very stringent. You have to meet three main criteria: the age, 18 to 60 years. You have to document that this is a true stroke, it's not a lacunar stroke. And number three, an expert neurologist or a stroke specialist has to make sure that the stroke is truly cryptogenic and not related to other conventional risk factors. So those are the three criteria that they have to meet. They don't emphasize the anatomical criteria. There are new trials that are being done where the patients are being enrolled purely on the basis of anatomical criteria, large PFO shunt and large atrial septal aneurysm. So when the results of these trials become available, my guess is that the guidelines will be upgraded to include the anatomical criteria for patient selection as well.
This has been a great discussion. As a way of summarizing, what would be a key take-home point that you would want our audience to remember?
So the device closure is effective in carefully selected patients, and it is important that there is a concept of this heart team, a cardiologist as well as neurologist, get together and make sure there's truly a cryptogenic stroke. And finally, you know, the patient's value judgments and preferences have to be considered before making a decision. So careful patient selection, a combined neurology-cardiology approach to assessment, and then patient value judgments and preferences.
Dr. Call, it's been a pleasure having you in the Axel studio today.
Thank you, Dr. Sketch.
This is Alfred Beauvais, Editor-in-Chief of Axel, and you've been listening to an interview from our recent issue. For more information on how to subscribe to Axel and receive additional interviews published each month, go to acc.org/accel.